Deep within the deserts of New Mexico lies one of the world's most valuable lost treasures. A treasure so valuable that if you were to discover it, would make your wildest dreams come true. To some, to even go looking for this lost treasure is a fool's errand, an absolute waste of time in a wild goose chase. But to others, you have to risk it for the biscuit. There are 16 tons of gold out there just waiting to be recovered by someone bold enough to spend their entire life looking for it. Perhaps it'll lay in the New Mexico desert until the heat death of the universe. Or perhaps it'll be found and dug up by someone. And perhaps that someone will be you.
Hit me with it.
Welcome back to episode number 13 of Super Mystery Bros, the podcast where we talk about the world's most riveting unsolved mysteries. As always, I'm Nate, and with me today is my co-host is Kyle, and we welcome you back to the world's most underrated podcast. Kyle, what can people do to lend us a hand as we dig for the truth through the sands of the unknown?
Well, Nate, as always, our loyal listeners can leave us a 5-star rating and review on Apple Podcasts, 5-star rating on Podify. Yeah, man. You haven't heard of that one? Spotify, Podchaser, Podcast Addict, or whatever you listen through. You know, a couple other unique ideas. You can talk to your crush about our awesome podcast. It's a great way to break the ice, right? Slip handwritten notes about our podcast into bags of food you deliver on Uber Eats, you know, or even go to a political protest and write "Listen to Super Mystery Bros" on a picket sign. Really get the word out there.
Yeah, that sounds good. If you could do any of those for us, we would be eternally grateful. So, Kyle, do you have anything else you want to say before we begin, man?
I don't believe so, man. Let's hit this.
Before the age of buying digital shitcoins and other types of magic internet tokens in the delusional conviction that they're just going to magically skyrocket in price for no reason, people had to buy low and sell high the old-fashioned way, through the buying and selling of shiny yellow chunks of rocks known as gold. In the old-timey days, acquiring a comically huge amount of gold was the endgame in the age-old pursuit of escaping from the cold, iron grip of wage slavery. By the beginning of the 1920s, life in the US was beginning to change dramatically, as social, economic, and political changes began to sweep across the nation, and for the first time in its history, more people began to live in cities than on farms. A wave of post-war optimism swept the country, as many believed that the war to end all wars had been fought and was now behind them. The nation's total wealth doubled over the course of the decade. The Roaring Twenties, as they were called, may have begun with a roar, but ended like the Hindenburg in a spectacular crash and burn as October 29th, 1929 rolled around, commonly known as Black Tuesday, where the stock market bubble finally began to pop and many investors were left holding heavy bags. Many had taken out mountains of debt only to invest it all at the top of the market, and economic growth began to slow drastically, causing a vicious feedback loop. A dramatic stock market sell-off ensued, and the following decade represented a dark time for the U.S., as the country collectively became significantly poorer overnight. To add insult to injury, the southwestern Great Plains region had begun to suffer from severe drought from 1930 to 1936, causing thousands of Oklahomans to head out California way. The period from late 1929 to the beginning of World War II became known as the Great Depression, the longest and deepest depression of the 20th century. Hope for the average American had reached an all-time low, and the dreams of many had been shattered into dust. However, As anybody with even an elementary level of financial literacy knows, economic downturns don't always have to be a huge bummer, and can actually represent the perfect opportunity for future financial gains. Buy low, sell high, as business and finance eggheads constantly say. It's no secret that the mega wealthy lie in wait during times of economic crisis, buying up all the stocks and other assets that regular people with weak hands sell off in panic as the market turns into a bloodbath. Nathan Rothschild, 19th century financier and member of the infamous Rothschild banking family himself, once said, "Buy when there's blood in the streets, even when it's your own." But what does that even mean, really? It means that the worse off that the market is, the better that the buying opportunities are going to be. In the early 1930s, one such plan to take advantage of the recent economic downturn in the U.S. was hatched by a group of opportunistic Mexican millionaires. But what started out as a simple buy low, sell high scheme would unwittingly transform into one of the most hilarious cases of lost treasure in North America, sending countless numbers of desperate treasure hunters on a wild goose chase through the deserts of New Mexico for decades to come.
Cuernavaca, Mexico, I'm assuming I'm pronouncing that right, located approximately 30 miles south of Mexico City. In 1933, a group of wealthy Mexican businessmen conspired to take advantage of the huge economic downturn happening in the U.S. The meeting consisted of Guzman Morata, who was a professor of economics at the University of Mexico, international banker Rafael Borrega, millionaire Leon Trabuco, and ranchers Ricardo Ortega and Carlos Sepulveda. That was a lot of language I don't speak as well as I should. Economics professor Guzman Morata reasoned that due to the Great Depression, the U.S. was about to devalue the dollar significantly, and estimated that the price of gold was due to shoot up by at least $10 an ounce from the measly $20.67 per ounce it was at the time, which represented a nearly 50% increase. During the meeting, they came up with a genius plan, a plan so bulletproof that they reckoned that if they didn't go through with it, it would mean that they literally hate money. Literally.
The plan was simple, but proved to be a revolutionary breakthrough in the world of dude bro finance. Step 1. Buy gold in Mexico. Step 2. Sell gold in the U.S. Step 3. Profit. The group decided to pool their money together and buy up as much gold as possible in Mexico. Everything from gold jewelry, coins, and teeth were all melted down into gold ingots at a makeshift Mexican foundry. 16 tons of gold in total were eventually acquired by the group with the intent of smuggling it all into the U.S. The plan was then to sit on it until the price of gold inevitably skyrocketed, after which they could then sell it all for a handsome, guaranteed profit. Leon Trabuco and Ricardo Ortega contributed 12 tons of the 16-ton total, with the remaining 4 tons being acquired by money which was provided by Ortega and Sepulveda, which Borrega then used to go around with and purchase more gold from small Mexican miners who would sell gold for cash.
However, as simple as this plan was, there were a couple of major risks that the group had to accept. For one, if they were caught smuggling gold over the border, they would all face lengthy prison sentences, as Mexico forbade the export of gold from the country, and likewise, it was also illegal to smuggle gold into the U.S. There were also some logistical challenges that they would have to overcome. For starters, how they would smuggle that much gold across the border in the first place would be challenge, number one. Next, the group had to keep it safe and hidden away from prying eyes, so a perfect, secluded hiding spot would be priority numero uno. Trabuco, being the largest stakeholder in the scheme, became the leader of it. His first objective was to seek out a safe place in the U.S. to hide the gold, but after not being able to find a suitable location, decided that it would be safer to simply bury it somewhere instead.
In the end, Trabuco decided upon a location near the Four Corners region of the U.S., which, for people who are geographically challenged, that's the junction of the four states of Colorado, New Mexico, Arizona, and Utah. And this was in a spot in an area near to Farmington, which is in northwestern New Mexico, as it was secluded enough to offer a secure hiding spot. Next, Tribuco got to work looking for a remote landing strip that he could use as the delivery site for the gold. He found a suitable one near Shipland, which is about 25 miles west of Farmington. He then sent a telegram to a crop dusting pilot from Utah named William C. Elliott, who is also referred to by the alias Red Moiser. In an episode of Unsolved Mysteries with Robert Stack from 1991, he's called Red Moiser, so from now on, we're going to place our blind trust into the almighty Robert Stack and refer to the pilot as Red Moiser. It's unclear how Tribuco learned of Moiser in the first place, but in the telegram, Tribuco offered Moiser $2,500 for his troubles if he would simply come and meet with him. He instructed him to tell nobody of the arrangement, and furthermore, included no information about the subject of the meeting or why he was being summoned at all. Moiser, having made very little money in his flying career, jumped at the opportunity to make an easy $2,500 and agreed to make the 700-mile round trip to Kirtland. So, just to clarify here, Tribuco located a place outside of Shipland that he could use as a landing strip for deliveries of the gold, but the actual meeting was arranged in Kirtland, which is actually pretty far away from each other.
2 days later, he landed his plane at the tiny airstrip outside of Kirtland, and upon getting out of his plane, was greeted by a Mexican man in a dark suit. Without speaking a word, he handed Moiser a typed note, which was from Tribuco, which had written instructions to meet him at the Kirtland Hotel. The Mexican man then motioned Moiser to a car that was waiting for them. Once at the hotel, Moiser met with Tribuco, and was given a map of the area near Pueblo, Mexico, where one of his largest ranches was located. Tribuco instructed Moiser that he was to land his plane at the ranch, pick up a cargo of gold ingots, and fly an evasive pattern back to New Mexico and land at a remote airstrip close to a small mesa northwest of Ship Rock. Tribuco said that several trips would be needed, as a total of 16 tons of gold were to be delivered. Upon completion of the entire delivery, Tribuco would pay Moiser $40,000 in cash, which is nearly $1 million today. Tribuco emphasized that the entire deal had to be kept secret. Just to clarify, Ship Rock is a city, but it's also a landmark that juts out of the desert about 10 miles southwest of the city. It's like a jagged mountain-looking thing. Also, the exact location of the airstrip was never confirmed. After a few minutes of mental deliberation, Moiser agreed to the proposition, which greatly pleased Tribuco. He was handed his promised $2,500 in cash and was instructed to make his first trip down to Puebla the following day.
As Moiser made his approach and touched down at Tribuco's ranch the following day in Puebla, Mexico, guards armed with machine guns immediately met with him and made him stand on one side as some laborers loaded the gold ingots onto his plane. He was then shown to his quarters and fed dinner. The following morning, after having breakfast, Moiser took off from the ranch and flew the route as instructed by Tribuco, avoiding Border Patrol and other law enforcement successfully, landing his plane at the makeshift airstrip located adjacent to the mesa near Ship Rock, New Mexico. This time, Tribuco drove a brand new pickup truck right up alongside the plane before Moiser even had time to cut the engines on his plane. Tribuco got out, and this time was dressed in khaki work clothes. Two assistants were also accompanying him.
As the story goes, Moiser was instructed to stand away from the plane as the two assistants began loading the gold ingots into the bed of the truck. He was informed that the gold was to be sealed in wax before then being buried in a secret location atop the mesa. After the deal was done, they shook hands, and Moiser watched as they drove away up a dirt road toward the top of the mesa. Over the next several weeks, Moiser made a total of 16 round trips to Puebla. On one occasion, curiosity got the better of him, and he decided that he wanted to know where the gold was being buried. Upon finishing the delivery, Moiser took off from the airfield, climbed to a high altitude, but instead of leaving the area, he loitered at a distance for a while before turning back toward the area and cutting his engines, silently gliding over the mesa in search of Tribuco's truck. He soon spotted it near the western edge of the mesa, and even from that high altitude, could see three men nearby excavating a shallow trench.
After completing his final trip, Tribuco paid Moiser the agreed amount of $40,000 in cash, and was told that in the event that the gold was eventually sold at a specified profit in the future, he would be given a significant bonus. The two parted ways, and Moiser eventually returned to Utah, $40,000 richer. For the Mexican conspirators, things seemed to be going well in the following months. The price of gold had soared, and their stashed fortune increased in value by well over $7 million. It was a genius move. They were euphoric. But the group decided to wait longer before selling, because they figured that the price would surely keep going up by more. $100 per ounce end of year. Diamond-encrusted titanium hands, baby. Right?
Wrong. What the group failed to anticipate was an executive order signed by then-President Franklin D. Roosevelt, which was signed on January 30th, 1934, which transferred ownership of all monetary gold in the United States to the U.S. Treasury. The group was shocked and horrified to learn that they had been rug pulled by the United States government. The following excerpt comes from the website federalreservehistory.org. Roosevelt's gold program, which began in 1933, first restricted the private use of gold, requiring businesses to apply to the Fed for gold bars. The Gold Reserve Act of 1934 was the culmination of this program. President Roosevelt signed the act on January 30, 1934. Section 2 of the act transferred ownership of all monetary gold in the United States to the U.S. Treasury. Monetary gold included all coins and bullion, ingots being bullion, held by individuals and institutions, including the Federal Reserve. In return, individuals and institutions received currency at a rate of $35 per ounce of gold. This rate reduced the gold value of the dollar to 59% of the value set by the Gold Act of 1900, which equaled $20.67 per ounce. That rate had prevailed until the spring of 1933, when the Roosevelt administration began its campaign to devalue the dollar. Sections 5 and 6 of the Act prohibited the Treasury and financial institutions from redeeming dollars for gold, inverting the system that had prevailed in the United States since the 19th century. Under that system, the government converted paper currency to gold coins whenever citizens desired to do so. Now, the government converted gold into dollars regardless of whether citizens wanted to engage in the exchange. Sections 3, 4, and 11 of the Act regulated the use of gold within the United States. Regulations govern the use, acquisition, transportation, importing, exporting, and possession of gold. For example, monetary gold had to be held as bars. Coins were forbidden. Bars could be attained by certain industrial users, such as the manufacture of dental appliances, jewelry, and electronics. Gold items could be bought and sold if they weighed less than 15 ounces, but transactions for heavier items required licenses. Violators faced stiff penalties. Section 10 of the Act established a stabilization fund of $2 billion under control of the Treasury. These funds came from the profits of the government. Let me start that over. These funds came from the profits the government earned when it raised the price of gold. The Treasury could use the Exchange Stabilization Fund, or ESF, to buy or sell gold, foreign currencies, financial securities, and other financial instruments in order to control the dollar's value and to conduct open market operations without the assistance or approval of the Federal Reserve. The Treasury could also use the ESF to transfer funds clandestinely to neutral nations and international allies. This, too, proved useful during World War II. Section 12 of the Act authorized the President to establish the gold value of the dollar by proclamation. The President did this the day after he signed the Act. Then, Roosevelt explained the purpose of these actions was to increase the supply of credit, to, quote, stabilize domestic prices, and to protect the foreign commerce against the adverse effect of depreciated foreign currencies, end quote, from Roosevelt in 1934. Wow, all man, right. That is a lot of legal jargon. Why don't you help our listeners and me understand all of that?
Yeah, so to break this down in a more easily digestible manner, the following excerpt comes from the world's most trusted source of information, Wikipedia. Immediately following the passage of the act, the president, Franklin D. Roosevelt, changed the statutory price of gold from $20.67 an ounce to $35. This price change incentivized gold miners globally to expand production and foreigners to export their gold to the United States while simultaneously devaluing the U.S. dollar by increasing inflation. The increase in gold reserves due to the price change resulted in a large accumulation of gold in the Federal Reserve and U.S. Treasury, much of which was stored in the United States Bullion Depository at Fort Knox and other locations. The increase in gold reserves increased the money supply, lowering real interest rates, which in turn increased investment in durable goods. So, in other words, it's simple economics, dear listener. I don't understand it at all. Basically, the Gold Act of 1934 made the private ownership of gold more or less illegal and took gold off the market, and the group missed their chance to sell their stash of gold to a private buyer entirely. The 16 tons of gold buried in the New Mexico desert was now a 16-ton paperweight that could get them all sent to prison if the government learned of it. The group had missed their chance to sell, and not only didn't profit from the endeavor, but lost the entire sum of their investment. Greed is a hell of a drug. Over the next several years, the men began to die off in strange, untimely deaths. Borrega died in his office in Mexico in 1939. Sepulveda died in a car accident near Monterey in 1940. And Red Moiser was killed in 1944 while serving as a pilot in World War II in the skies over Europe. Eventually, the last man standing was Tribuco himself. In 1952, he tried to cut a deal with the U.S. government, which backfired and prompted a grand jury investigation, but luckily for him, he was never indicted. Tribuco ended up dying several years later, the same way that he lived, bag holding. Legend has it that he never drew a map or told a single person about the location of the treasure and took the secret to his grave.
Ed Foster, a self-proclaimed treasure hunter who grew up in Farmington, New Mexico, searched for the lost treasure for over 35 years, and although he never found the treasure itself, believes he narrowed down its location. The following excerpt comes from Unsolved Mysteries with Robert Stack, Season 4, Episode 11, which aired in 1991. Ed Foster searched for Tribuco's treasure in the desert around Farmington, New Mexico. He's convinced that he found the 1933 landing strip used by Red Moiser on a plateau called Conger Mesa.
Quote, "I believe that Conger Mesa is where the plane would adjust and come in and land. I met this Indian lady that couldn't speak English, so I got an interpreter. She said she had watched that plane land there many, many times," end quote.
Ed interviewed another Navajo woman who was 6 years old in 1933. Ed said she remembered several Mexican men who lived on the reservation.
Quote, "This would be very unusual for a Mexican to move out here. For a Spanish or a white man to move out here and live would be unheard of," end quote.
20 miles west of the mesa, near an old Navajo home, stands a building unlike any other on the reservation. Ed believes it was built by men Tribuco hired to guard the gold.
Quote, "This house has windows, a front door, and a back door, and it had a veranda. To me, this house would look good in Tijuana, Mexico, but not on the Navajo reservation," end quote.
Ed also found another intriguing clue, a date and some words etched in the face of a stone outcropping. He calls it Shrine Rock and believes it may be the key to finding Tribuco's treasure. It reads, 1933, 16 ton. Ed is sure that the gold is buried somewhere within this triangle formed by Conger Mesa, Shrine Rock, and the Mexican-style home. Ed asked renowned treasure hunter Norman Scott to make a detailed survey of the area.
Quote, I get an awful lot of stories coming to us after 30 years in the business, and probably about 80 or 90% of them you have to chalk up to some fictional writer who is writing a book or a magazine. But this one has a ring of authenticity to it. End quote.
Ed Foster had a plan.
Quote, I have looked with my eyes in metal detectors for many years, and now they have technology, and that's why I think it's going to be found with technology. It's not going to be found with dumb luck, because I've spent all of that. End quote. Is Ed Foster just chasing a legend? Or does the desert of New Mexico hold the secret to Leon Trabuco's long-lost fortune? End of excerpt. All right, so let's just talk for a moment about this Unsolved Mysteries episode. Can you help our listeners by breaking down what they were talking about?
So, basically, this self-proclaimed treasure hunter has discovered three points of interest in the search for Trabuco's gold. What he believes to be the landing strip Red Moiser used to drop off the gold atop of Conger Mesa, a house on a Navajo reservation that looked more like a Mexican or Spanish style home and didn't match any other homes out there, as well as a stone outcropping he found that had 1933 16 ton etched into the rock. So these were all spaced out, and so he kind of used it to draw a triangle on a map and said, somewhere between these three points of interest, the gold is buried. I'm sure of it.
Yeah, pretty much. So the sum of 16 tons of gold would be worth nearly $1 billion in 2023. To this day, the treasure has never been found, at least not publicly. Nearly 90 years after being buried somewhere in the middle of the New Mexico desert, it may still be out there, laying just beneath the surface, waiting to be found by someone. Could that someone be you? All right, man, that brings us to the end of our episode. So I would like to know if you have any thoughts about this treasure, where it could be, or if it even exists at all. Do you think it's still out there somewhere?
I think that's highly possible that it's still out there. It is curious to know where any of this information came from, because Trabuco was so secretive about it all. You know, that there was nothing in any of the research that said that Red Moiser made like a diary. So I'm not sure how they knew that, you know, he flew high one day to find out where they were burying it.
So that was according to what one of his friends telling him this. He told one of his friends this story. So there's a lot of hearsay with this story, and it's really hard to verify a lot of the claims in the story. So I guess that brings me to what I want to talk about when it comes to this is, I'm not convinced that this treasure was real in the first place, because it's hard to verify where this story came from in the first place, because a lot of sources in this story kind of conflicted with each other. Like, I bought a book that had this story, the story of this lost treasure in it, and it conflicted with the Unsolved Mysteries episode. So one of the conflicts between the two stories was that the book that I read said that Trabuco died in prison, whereas the Robert Stack episode showed that he died a free man. So it's kind of hard to verify this story in general. I kind of don't trust the story as it's told, because it seems more like a legend than an actual factual story. But as for the Mexican style house that Ed Foster, that's the guy, the Mexican style home that Ed Foster found. So let's assume for a moment that Trabuco did hire some people to watch over the gold just in the middle of the desert. Well, that leaves witnesses that know where the gold is buried. So after Trabuco died, who's to say that those people who knew where the gold was didn't come back and take the gold for themselves? So true. even if this story is true, I highly fucking doubt that the gold is still there.
Yeah. Well, between that Mexican home and the stone outcropping that says 1933 16 ton, you know, but granted, that could have been etched by anyone at like any time. You know, I mean, like, it seems vague, but at the same time, it's also oddly specific to the story.
But, yeah, exactly.
Yeah. Yeah, I don't know, man. Yeah, it's hard to say. Been looking for it for so long. But one of the things in the information said that they coated the gold in wax before burying it.
Yeah, which is a really... So one thing that makes me really sus of this story is why Tribuco would tell Red Moiser anything about where he's going to bury the gold or how he's going to bury it. But the book that I picked up, which told this story, said that he told Red Moiser that he was going to embalm it all in wax and bury it up at the top of the mesa. Well, why would Tribuco tell him any of that information at all? Like, there's no reason to do that. And that's yeah. Telling him something like that would be a liability.
Yeah. So maybe lie on purpose to throw him off, right? But also, according to the story, Red Moiser flew above the mesa and saw two dudes digging a trench, you know.
Unless they were, like, really fucking stupid.
Well, they're smart enough to come up with a plan. And then, you know, I guess it wasn't really stupidity. It was more just greed that let them miss their shot.
Yeah, know? Exactly. Yeah. So if you were to go out and look for this treasure, how would you go about doing it? Would you be like boomer style with a metal detector waving it across the ground? I think they would have buried it really deep, actually.
Yeah. Well, I mean, deep. Yeah. Not too deep for metal detectors, because they didn't have metal detectors back then. They would have, you know, they wouldn't plan for that. I'm curious as to, like, if a piece of metal is wrapped in wax, would that deflect a metal detector?
I don't think so. I think it would still pick it up. But I think the depth would matter. Yeah, I don't think... Yeah. I think they would have buried it deeper. Because, you know, the desert sands, they shift constantly. I think they would have buried it deeper than what a metal detector could pick up. So it's kind of like, if this treasure is really out there, unless there's some landmark that says 16 tons of gold are buried right here, I don't think this shit's ever going to get discovered. Not by an average person, anyway.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, it also doesn't say, like, where Ed Foster's been digging and looking. I mean, like, if I went out there, the first two places I would look would be right at Shrine Rock, like, in that immediate vicinity. Or even in the immediate vicinity of that Mexican-style home, right? Like, if you hired two dudes to watch over the location of the gold, only two guys, like, wouldn't you want the location to be within view of your front porch? So you could, like, keep an eye on it without going anywhere?
Yeah, that's probably where I would start looking, too. I would start looking, yeah. I wouldn't... Man, that's really hard to say. It's such an open mystery, man. To me, it's a fucking wild goose chase. I'm not even convinced that this treasure is still out there, if it even was at all to begin with. Because if they really did hire people to watch over the gold and they all died, well, this still leaves some witnesses who know where the gold is. So it makes no fucking sense.
Yeah. Yeah, I get you. I don't know. For the sake of the episodes, I like to just, you know, believe, you know, romantically, that there's a higher possibility for basically anything we go over, any episode we do. I'm like, yeah, man, that actually happened. Yeah. You know, I don't know. Just feels good to believe.
What would you do with $1 billion in gold?
Oh, Jesus Christ, man. Oh, I know. I would buy a huge plot of land somewhere, and I would open a free roam, like animal shelter for dogs. And I would just take in, like, old dogs and just give them a good last couple of years. Just let them run around giant grass field. Yeah. That sounds like the life right there, man.
See, to me, man, I don't even know if I would want that much money. Because I think when you have that much money, it equals ultimate freedom. And when you have ultimate freedom with no restrictions, I think that would cause anybody to kind of lose their mind.
Maybe. I don't know. I was talking to someone who was, what were they doing? They were like installing solar on some billionaire's property and they're talking to like the wife, and she was like really open about it, you know, and the dude asked her like, hey, like, what's it like being a billionaire? And her answer was, you get sued a lot. People you've never heard of are trying to sue you and get a chunk of your money for free every single week.
Yeah. So is that a life that you would really want to lead? People, no. you would never know if you have real friends or if they're only hanging around you because of the money you have.
Yeah, this is true. Yeah,
I would like to have $10 million, but I don't know about a billion. I think I would lose my mind after a billion.
Yeah. I think in today's world, if you're a billionaire or a multi-billionaire, you know, you should all.
Let's get back on track, though, man. Yeah.
I didn't mean to make it political. I didn't think that was going to be political. My bad.
No worries. All right. So how would you go about excavating this much gold? Let's say you were just like stumbling around in the desert and you magically stumbled upon it. Like, what would your next step be?
That's a great question. There's no way in hell that you're going to move 16 tons of gold without being prepared to move that much weight. You know, if you're just out there in your car or your truck, even if you drive a really big pickup truck, you know, you'd be lucky to put 1,000 pounds in the back of a pickup truck and have it still be drivable, you know. So that's a fraction, a 1/32nd fraction of the entire weight. So you'd have to mark it somehow, you know, where you could find it, but not be too obvious. Might be a little easier nowadays with, you know, GPS on your phone and whatnot. But yeah, you would have to mark it and then come up with a plan, find some people you really trust, because you're going to want to get that out of there sooner rather than later before someone else finds it, right? Like, you're not just going to make 32 separate trips out there, you know? No, you're going to want to swoop that up. So you don't want to get a team together, people who own commercial trucks or rent a commercial truck or something. They can move it all in a couple of loads. Where you would hide it next is kind of beyond me. You know, you could almost leave it in place until you could find out how to convert it to real money. I'm not entirely sure. What would you do?
Yeah, so what I would do if I found the gold, I probably wouldn't tell anybody. I would probably keep it there in place, and then that becomes my hiding place. Because like, I don't see a need to move the gold. I can just keep it there and keep it hidden and just go there as needed to remove gold to sell. Because like, I don't think you would need to remove the gold from where it is. You can just leave it there and take your gold as needed.
Yeah, I like that. I like that idea. That makes a lot more sense, you know, than sharing the location with other people, you know, cashing it all in at once, making yourself high profile, kind of rich. Yeah. Yeah. You just, you know, yeah. Like you said, as needed, pick at it slowly, like over time, as long as no one else finds it. I mean, yeah, sure. You won't be a billionaire, but you're going to live pretty comfortably for the rest of your life, and you're never going to have to worry about money again.
Yeah. Would you tell the government or your friends or family about it?
I don't fucking think so, man. You just be like, nah, I got a raise at work, man. I'll buy dinner tonight. You know, my treat.
That's probably what I would do too. Because once you come into money like that, everyone comes out of the woodwork wanting a piece of it.
Yeah. Yeah, money does weird things to people, especially big amounts of money, life-changing amounts of money, which is what you will have stumbled upon if you found that gold.
This $1 billion, man, with a B.
Yeah.
Yeah. All right, man, do you have anything else that you want to discuss before we go?
I don't think so, man. I think we did another bang-up job here.
All right, man. Do you have any apologies, shout-outs, clarifications, or crow to eat?
Crow to eat. That's a new one.
Do you need to eat crow for some reason?
I don't think so, man. Not in the mood for crow today. I would like to apologize for getting political on our podcast, which we strictly try to make non-political. This is just for you, the listeners. You know, we are talking about the world's most important unsolved mysteries only, and it's completely for your education and entertainment. No one wants to hear political BS where you're trying to enjoy the world's greatest unsolved mystery podcast. My apologies if you'll please strike what I said from the record about how billionaires should spend their money and live their lives. That was an accident.
How fucking dare you, man?
How fucking dare I? I would also like to shout out to my next door neighbor, Sarah, for letting me borrow her staple gun after I broke mine. My entire project I was working on completely went to shit, and I couldn't have finished it without her. So thank you, Sarah. You were a lifesaver.
All right, man. I'd like to apologize for making fun of shitcoin flippers the world over. I hope that your shitcoins moon to $10 million end of year, and that all of your wildest dreams come true. Because without hope, life just isn't worth living.
Well, thank you, Nate. I really do hope my $30 investment into shitcoins blooms to $10 million by the end of the year.
I hope you do a 1 million X, honestly.
Oh, thank you.
All right, man. Well, I think it's about time to get out of here. Like sands through the hourglass, so too are the minutes of our podcast. But don't fret, dear listener. We'll be back again to breathe new life into an old mystery next time.
Remember, folks, the truth is out there, somewhere in the ether, and through our powers combined, we'll solve that sumbitch, once and for all.
This is Super Mystery Bros.
Shout out to my left big toenail. I miss you.
What happened to it?
I lost it years ago. Fucking when Loki and Leah were still puppies, they were out in like the front yard and they were like screaming bloody murder. Apparently like Leah's tooth got caught in like Loki's collar. They're freaking the fuck out. So I ran outside, got him detached, brought him in. And I was like, my fucking toe hurts. And I looked down and there was all this like blood coming out of my sock.
Oh my God, dude.
I didn't like notice, but my best guess is when I threw the door open, I just hit my fucking toe, right? And just like didn't even notice. Like I got in, I was like, why is my toe hurt? Why is there a bunch of blood on my sock? And my toenail is all like super loose, the big one. And I tried to keep it for like a month and eventually it just fucking fell off.